Well, I appreciate those words. That's a lot to live up to. Good to be with you this morning, and I look forward to the week together as we think about encounters of Jesus with different people. If you have your New Testaments, open with us to Matthew, the 15th chapter, and we want to look this morning at the Canaanite woman, where Jesus says to her, "Great, great is your faith." It's a joy to be with you. I've been with you before, and I look always forward to coming back. As Jeff mentioned, we have a lot of your young people right now. We've got Sarah McFarland and Laura McDonald and Katie Stevenson, and I know I'm going to leave somebody out, so tell me later if I miss somebody. Of course, we've got Catherine Berwitz, who used to be Catherine Treat, and they live there now, so great joy to work with young people, great joy to watch their faith. I was thinking about the young men that were serving on the Lord's table. What a joy it is for anybody my age to watch young people decide that they believe that truth, that we have been passing on. If we are the faithful men and women that are passing on to the next generation, the faith of Jesus Christ, and that has to be done through living examples and firm convictions. And are these the truths that we should believe? And we try to present them from the Word of God. And so we do the best that we can and hope that the next generation will do better than us in a lot of ways and will also hold to the things that are firmly so. Appreciate Jeff and Amanda, his wife, and appreciate their love for this congregation, their love for the work. Jeff and I have been good friends now for a number of years and appreciate his work that he does. I just always feel like when I listen to guys like him preach and I listen to Brent when he preaches that I'm thinking, why am I doing this? That's always how you feel, I think, about other guys. You appreciate them. We are friends that hone each other, and if you think this is just something you get up and do, sometimes I get tickled at the young people. They'll come up to me. Laura McDonald is my adopted daughter. We adopt different kids out so that everybody, the elders, aren't having to watch after, 100. We have 120 college kids. So how do you watch out for that many people? So we adopt them out. And she came up to me one time and she said, "Well, what do you do every day?" And so I always get so tickled at that when you're a gospel preacher. Well, I sit around and watch soap operas and the sports and it just flies out on Saturday. I just type it out on a little index card, and here it goes. And I wasn't trying to be unkind to her, but if you know what kind of work goes into what you do, I appreciate being with my colleagues, and that's what times like this afford for me, is a chance to be around Jeff and Brent and Reuben, and get to hone yourself. You always pick up things and you learn things. So good to be with you. Look forward to the week together. Matthew, the 15th chapter. Begin with us at verse 21. "And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon, and behold, a Canaanite woman from the region came out and was crying, 'Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon.' But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, 'Send her away, for she is crying out after us.' He answered, 'I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel.' But she came and knelt before him, saying, 'Lord, help me.' And he answered, 'It is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.' She said, 'Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table.' Then Jesus answered her, 'O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire.' And her daughter was healed instantly." I'm going to tell you, there's a tremendous passage of Scripture, isn't it? Only time that we have recorded that Jesus was outside of Jewish territory during his ministry. I think it foreshadows the gospel going out as it would to the whole world. It wasn't going to be a Jewish church. It was going to be a church made up of Jews and Gentiles. It was the beginning of the end of barriers, maybe. But I want you to think about how the English Standard describes her. It says, "Behold, a Canaanite woman." Your version may say Syrophoenician. That was a particular region that she was from. But I want you to note the English Standard chooses the word Canaanite. Now stop there and think for that for a minute. In the New Testament, there's only a couple of other usages. That's where Stephen recounts the history of God's people, so obviously why he would bring it up in Acts, the 7th chapter. But she is descended from the very Old Testament Canaanites, that God had told Israel to wipe off the face of the map. When you read in Exodus 23 and verse 28 and other passages that they were to be destroyed outside, they were not to leave any of them alive because of the despicableness of their practices. Remember that he told Abraham, the cup of the Amorite standing again for all of the Canaanites, the cup of the Amorites' iniquity is not yet full. And he would have patience and long-suffering with them for another four centuries before finally the destruction that he had to bring, the judgment that he brings upon all ungodly people, had to be brought against the Canaanites. The things that we find out sometimes in archaeology, where when they were building the walls of a city, they would bury babies alive in urns and dedicate them to the gods, and they placed them there. They made their sons and daughters pass through the fire, as you read in the Old Testament, to the god Molech, where they would roll babies down into a burning fire and offer them as living sacrifices to these gods. And when you think about the despicable sexual practices they used to even call their priests and priestesses that perform these terrible things holy. They use the same word that God uses for his people and for the priests of God as holy. And on you could go, the despicableness of them. And yet that's who this woman is. They had not destroyed all of them, as the scriptures had said. She has a daughter, we are told at verse 22, is severely demon-possessed. Some versions say badly demonized or suffering horrors. And she cries out to him in a tense that we don't have in our language, but it means in the perfect tense, from the beginning she kept on crying. I think you get that out of the fact that the disciples say, just get rid of her. I mean, do what she wants and get rid of her. Because she just kept on persistently crying out to him. The true faith can be found where we least expect it. And often in Scripture, that's so. Rahab the harlot, Naaman the leper, the church at Corinth, and here in this woman. The gospel, as one man said, is not about place. It is about believers, wherever they may be. So I want you to think how vital it is to persevere in prayer. Let's think about three things, and these I got from Tack Chumley's commentary, and we'll have a quote from him in a minute. The first is, he said, Jesus ignored her. Notice verse 23, he answered her not a word. My wife sometimes comes in when I'm watching something on TV, and she'll start talking to me, and then she starts talking like she's talking to herself, and I catch up with what's going on, but I hadn't paid any attention to her. That is a bad thing, young guys. Don't do that. When your wife comes in, just, you know, click the TV off, turn your attention to her. You'll go a long way in life better than I've had to put up with. When you think about ignoring somebody, that is an ultimate insult. You remember the occasion when they brought the woman to him that had committed adultery, and literally the text says they thrust her down. They threw her down in the midst of him and said, we caught this woman in the very act of adultery. The law of Moses says stone her to death. What do you say? As if they thought they could trip up the master teacher. As if they could trip up the Son of God. What the text says he did. The text says that he stooped down and he wrote with his finger on the ground. Can you imagine? Somebody comes in and puts before you that kind of ultimatum. Not only do you ignore them and not answer them anything, you stoop down and write on the ground. In fact, the text says that they kept on asking him. What kind of tone do you think they upped it to when they saw him do what they did? But finally, he rises up and he says, he that is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone. And one by one, the text says, they went out from the oldest to the youngest until when Jesus would look at her and say, woman, where are thy accusers? She says, they're not here, neither do I accuse you. But he said to her, go and sin no more. To ignore her. Secondly, it says that he excluded her. He just looks at her and says, basically, I am sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Lady, you are a Gentile, not just a Gentile, the Canaanites. Therefore, you have no claim on me, on my care, my time, or my power. I mean, the ultimate insult. Period. End of story. No legitimate claim on me. And yet, she will not listen to that. This woman basically worships Jesus by saying, "Lord, help me." And I want you to notice that she knows something about him. Isn't that interesting? Something that is tied directly into the Old Testament with King David. She says, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David." She has heard about him, or maybe she has listened to him. She knows this about him. Can you imagine, this woman has a daughter severely demon-possessed. Think of all the things she must have tried to heal her daughter, to help her daughter. And she comes and throws herself down. And you would have think that, this would have broken the heart of Jesus. That's the Jesus I read in my Bible. You read too. Who is this guy? You ever have those commercials, those St. Jude Hospital commercials, and those little kids come up, their heads are shaved. They may have a scar on their head because of the surgeries, and the parents are the ones that usually are the ones that are crying. And so while the thing's going on, I've got my checkbook out, you know, and just, you just feel like compassion for little kids. Where is John 3:16 here? And yet the woman will not let go of Jesus. And finally, here's the ultimate insult. "Lady, you're a dog. You're a dog." And you have to think back to the time that dogs were not family pets like they are now. My dog lives in our house, and she has to pretty much behave like one of my kids. Not that good, but she behaves pretty okay to live with us. But that didn't happen much in this time. I think in this text, obviously, in her response, she has the mind of the richer people that would have had dogs, the little dogs that would eat the crumbs that fell from their master's table. But dogs basically were scavengers. Remember, they came and licked Lazarus' sores in the story that Jesus tells. They ate the body of Jezebel. Do you remember that? Only the hands and her head were left. Not the household pet that we think of, even though she seems to be saying that when she responds to him. Sometimes you'll run across a commentary that'll say, "Well, maybe he was playfully dealing with her." I'm going to tell you, there's nothing to me, and you read this text, that he is playing with her at all. He is accusing her, or insulting her, as we would say, as being a dog. Here's where the point that I got from Tack Chumley's commentary. By ignoring, excluding, and insulting this desperate mother, Christ never seemed more un-Christ-like. And yet she meets his challenge. At that point, I would have said, that's enough. At home where I am, to illustrate this when I preach the lesson, I said, what if somebody accused y'all, I looked at the young people, of being a longhorn? And that was enough. They got the point. It'd be the same thing of thinking about something so utterly insulting that's it. I'm done with you. I have pled, I have tried. But she will not. She takes that insult, accepts it, and says, "Yea, Lord. But even the little dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master." I may be a dog. I accept that. But dogs get to eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. How easily we are discouraged. That we would just give up. That, "God, we are done with you." When I read that passage about Paul saying in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 8, "We are afflicted in every way, yet not crushed." The idea there is how they would press olives to get the oil out, that they would use heavy rocks on, like think of putting olives in a burlap type, something that the oil can come out, and then they would crush them. That you're in, as we say, between a rock and a hard place. We are afflicted in every way, yet not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. You ever perplexed about God? You have a young couple that just got married not long into their marriage. You may know who I'm talking about. He contracted a tumor that, in 90% of the cases, is benign. But when they did the surgery on our young brother 10%. 10%. His was cancer. Such a rare cancer that the only specialist that exists pretty much in the United States is an MD Anderson. That some of our doctors, we have five or six doctors in the congregation at home, had heard, one of them was a radiologist oncologist, he said, I'd heard of this cancer. But that's as far as he could go. I'd heard of it. Do you think sometimes when things like that happen, God, what are you doing? Why should this happen to a powerfully active, spiritually minded, loving and wanting to do more and grow? What are you doing? You ever been perplexed with God? You live long enough, and you will be greatly perplexed. Persecuted. Listen to him, but not forsaken. Even struck down, if we die, we are not destroyed. I struggle with those two verses. I think I would have given, I'll give up about the time we get to perplex and not even try, persecuted and struck down. When I was in high school, we had to read, for me it was later, but the guy that I got it from was talking about that in high school. They read Elie Wiesel's book, Night. Was looking at that the other night, thinking about this lesson. Elie Wiesel was taken to Auschwitz, and when they put out his mother and father and sister, the women were separated from the men, and that's the last time he saw his mother and sister. They perished in that camp. His father died in his arms, and he was the only one to survive. There's a story that he tells in that very short book about a boy that was caught stealing food and was brought out and hung in front of all the prisoners were brought out, and that it took that boy 30 minutes because his body was so light to die. And a voice arose in the crowd behind him saying, "Where is God? Where is he now?" I tell you, the longer that you go in life, the greatest struggle you will have with God is not the design that's everywhere, is not his great power, his majesty. It will be his love. It will be perplexed over situations like this woman has with her daughter. Where is God? Where is he now? So that the Apostle Paul writes to us in Galatians 6 and verse 9, "And let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up." Why does he have to say that to us? Unless it is because we do grow so weary of doing good. We run away like Elijah sometimes. It just gets too hard. And there he is on the top of Mount Carmel, and he has succeeded beyond anybody's wildest dreams, and he takes all 400 of those false prophets and does what the Scriptures say in the Old Testament to do, and he slaughters them at the brook that's below there at Kishon. And then Jezebel sends him word and says, "The gods do more to me if I do not make you like one of them by tomorrow at this time." And Elijah hightails it, as we say. He goes all the way down to the border, southern border of the land of Palestine. And an angel meets him there and gives him water and food. That with that, he goes in strength to Mount Horeb, wherever Mount Sinai was. Leave that up to your studies. But he goes in the strength on that food alone to there. And then you remember the great story that is told. How wind comes and tears into. If you've ever looked at those mountains and thought about how they look just like solid rock, and a wind tears into it, an earthquake, and then fire, probably lightning, and then finally this stillness, no one knows quite how to translate it, small voice. And Elijah wraps himself in his mantle and comes to it, and God asks him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Twice he asked him that. And he says, I only am left. They have slaughtered all of the other prophets. And now they seek my life. And God says to him, "Oh, Elijah, I'm so sorry. that you have suffered so. It's not what he said, is it? He says, get up. Just like he says to Joshua at Achan's deal, get up and go back and anoint Elisha as prophet in your place, Jehu as king over Israel, and anoint the king of Syria. And you leave the counting to me. For there are 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal in Israel. The work Elijah had done and the work the other prophets had done, there was still a core of faithful. And yet, we run away because all we can see is what is in front of us. And sometimes it gets so perplexing and so hard that we give up. This woman would not let go of God. So God must be sought diligently to find Him. How badly do we want Him? Because this business of seeking God is a hard and arduous journey. It is not for the faint of heart. It is not for the easily discouraged. It is not for any that would just think overnight we're going to be transformed somehow into the image of His Son. And sometimes, folks, I think this, when the night is darkest, what I can sometimes think about passages of Scripture, when the night is darkest, it is only then that God comes to us and rescues. The passage in the New Testament talks about He had sent the disciples out on the Sea of Galilee, and He was watching after He had prayed from the shore. He saw that they were making their headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth hour of the night, in the wee hours from 3 in the morning to 6 a.m., the darkest part of the night, He came to them walking on the sea. But have you ever read the passage, and I end it right there, He meant to pass them by. He just meant to walk by them. I don't know how close He came to them. But they understood as they watched Him, as the Scriptures is just indicating to us, He did not intend to go to them. They cry out to Him, and He does alter His course and come to them. As if it is in the darkest place when we appeal to God, when we need Him in our most desperate hour, that only then He comes. You think of Jacob in the Old Testament, when he hears that Esau is coming to meet him with 400 armed men. What's the last thing Jacob remembered about Esau? Those 20 years before, he had stolen his birthright, he had stolen his blessing, and Esau said, I'll kill him when Isaac dies. When our dad dies, I'll kill him. That's the last thing he had heard. Knew about Esau. So now Esau comes with 400 armed men. So Jacob divides his company into two, and he puts, even when he gets to the wives, he puts the handmaids and their sons in front, and then he puts Leah and her boys, and finally he puts his favorite wife Rachel and Joseph in the back. Benjamin has not yet come. And then he sends out great herds and flocks and says, put a great distance between you. And when Esau gets to each of you and says, what is the meaning of this? This is a present from, he says, to my lord Esau from your servant Jacob. And he's trying to soften him up. And if he attacks one group, then the other can escape. And so Jacob himself goes over the deep Jabbok and gets on the other side, and he's by himself. And do you think he slept one wink that night? And then all of a sudden, in the middle of the night, in darkness, a guy attacks him. It's just amazing when you read the Bible of how it appeals to us on so many different levels. And you love the narratives and the stories, but how God comes, and He doesn't just always walk up to somebody and say, okay, look. But He came as a man in the middle of the night and attacked Jacob. And they're wrestling. And how do you think they're wrestling? You know, two brothers that have grown up together wrestle with one another. Maybe they occasionally try to kill one another, but probably not always their intention. But Jacob's thinking, what? they're wrestling as if, I would think, Jacob is trying to kill this man, or at least seriously disable him. And they are wrestling until the point that it goes on and on until the man takes his finger and touches the socket of his hip, and immediately Jacob's socket is thrown. Not something that normally would happen. Jacob gets the point. It says that he holds on to him because the man says, and get the irony of this, let me go. When he had just disabled him, made it impossible for Jacob to really wrestle with him. In fact, it says he limped away, and that to that day the Israelites do not eat that part of the meat that's on that seat. Maybe because Jacob limped the rest of his life. He said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. He said, your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For here you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. What is God after in us? That we struggle with Him and prevail. That through our perplexity, through our suffering, through our not knowing why this is happening to us, we do not, just like Jacob, we will not let go of God. Because this woman would not. Think of how hard she had been tried, how many tears she must have shed for her daughter, how many fruitless cures she must have tried. As the psalmist says in 119:71, it is good for me that I was afflicted, that I might learn your statutes. It was good for me that I was afflicted. The last thing you and I want is to have to be afflicted. We sit in padded pews and climate-controlled air. God forbid that it gets 2 degrees too warm or cold. And we'll learn absolutely nothing until God afflicts us. That young family I told you about, when his wife writes, she writes some of the very best stuff that I've ever seen her write, and good things that we all need to read. And I told her one time, I said, I believe this, that we do our best work only when we're kicked around some or a lot. Until we suffer, do we not truly understand what it means to be a disciple? Affliction, as one man says, introduces us to ourselves. Listen to him. Affliction introduces us to ourselves. And 9 times out of 10, you're not going to like that self that you see staring back at you. Not the first go-round, not the second, not the third. When we are afflicted, God is molding us and shaping us. And without affliction, as one man had said, J.C. Ryle, she might have lived and died in careless ignorance and never seen Jesus at all. If we think we will go through this life and never suffer, sometimes you look at families and all their kids are healthy and everything seems to be going right and nothing just seems to be wrong with them. As one man said one time in writing about that, he said they are drunk on life. And it takes a sobering awakening that comes by means of affliction. The last great thing I think about this passage is that the script has not been written in stone. Marvel that we can change God's mind. Marvel that the great Creator, who has all power and makes decisions and speaks, can alter what He decides. Because He loves us that much. You know, Calvinism in its purest form declares that all things have been determined by God. I've never met a pure Calvinist, but if you take Calvin's theory, it is everything. All the minute things you did this morning, everything to what you chose to eat, everything is ordained by God because He is the infinite sovereign. But if that is so, then you think about these passages where it says He is greatly moved by our faith. Wouldn't that make God a fake if Calvinism is true? When Jesus heard this, remember the centurion that said, look, I'm a man of authority. You don't need to come to my house. I have servants. I have soldiers. And if I say do this, they do it. And I say go there, they go. You just speak the word and my servant will be healed. And the scripture says, I tell you that I have not found, he marveled, I have not found such faith in Israel that's in this Gentile centurion. And if all was written in stone, if the story was decided from the beginning to the end, that God is unalterable, then how could he marvel? How could he ever be surprised? Because that's what it's saying, folks. That you and I can do things. Do your kids ever do things? Sometimes my son, you know, you look at him sometimes and you think, that comes from my wife's side of the family. But then sometimes you look at your kids and they do something that is so extraordinary that you just do exactly like Jesus. You marvel. That God has put within us the same heart that's in him. Not that we are God, but we are made in his image. And the same love that he has for us, we have the ability to extend back to him. And it is an amazing thing that we can please our God. A little, I think, though, that we trust. James says to us in chapter 5, 11, behold, we consider those blessed who remain steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job, and you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. You think about what he is saying. You have seen the endurance of Job, the steadfastness that he would not let go of God. And in the end, even though he said hard things about God, even though he thought hard things, even though he had to finally not even know the answer, but that God just bedazzles him with, do you understand these things? And if you cannot tell me how I do these, how can you purport to understand even greater? To know that the end is that our God is a God of mercy and a God of great compassion. At the end of the Civil War, on October 5th, 1864, Sherman had taken Atlanta, crossed the Chattahoochee to pursue Joseph Johnson's Confederates who had withdrawn. John Bell Hood, the Texan, was ordered by Johnston to slip behind Sherman's lines and destroy the railroad, the Union's main supply depot at Allatoona Pass. Sherman rushed Brigadier General John McCorse to intercept Hood, barely arriving with half his division, only 2,000 men. He immediately confronted a superior force of 3,000 Confederates under Samuel G. French. As one man said, you win battles by getting there first with the most. French gave Corse 5 minutes to unconditionally surrender and, quote, avoid a needless effusion of blood. Corse shot back his terse reply, we are prepared for the needless effusion of blood whenever it suits you. With that, the battle commenced, and it was a savage engagement. Both sides lost heavily. The Union lost one-third of its men. In a matter of minutes, 2 out of 3 redoubts fell to the Confederates. But Corse held firm to the last one, being shot through the cheekbone and losing one of his ears, a scar he bore the rest of his life. For one reason, Sherman had signaled him that morning from the top of Kennesaw Mountain, hold fast, we are coming. And French withdrew at 4 p.m. because 60,000 Federals were coming from all different directions. There was a song that was written out of this story, Hold the Fort. No one knows exactly what was said. I love the hold fast part. Hold fast. Almost the ending words of the book of Revelation. I am hold fast. is the greatest effort we will put forth in this life as we struggle with God and prevail. May we be like this wonderful woman, and maybe we'd be radically changed. If you're subject to heaven's invitation, Jesus said, he that believes and is baptized shall be saved. He believes not shall be condemned. If we can help you come back to him this morning, all together we stand and while we sing.